Welcome to Cracked, the podcast, the program that slays the dragons of mental health by stripping away the shame, embarrassment, fear, and stigma. Because mental health isn't something that affects just some of us, it applies to all of us. Here to shine a new light on areas of mental health that often go unvisited are your hosts, Rebecca Shaper and Sandy Sedgebeer.
Hello and welcome to Crack the Podcast, Slaying the Dragons of Mental Health, with me, Sandy Sedgebeer.
And me, Rebecca Shaper.
And as the headlines continue to focus attention on the worst pandemic in living memory, there's another epidemic that has been steadily and relentlessly decimating more and more people's lives over the last 50 years. Strangely, despite all the highly touted advances science, psychiatry, and the pharmaceutical industry have made in uncovering and treating the biological causes of mental and behavioural disorders during that time, the number of disabled mentally ill in the USA and other parts of the world has skyrocketed. With us today to shine some much needed light on this is award-winning science journalist and author Robert Whittaker, whose books include Mad in America, Bad Science, Bad Medicine, and The Enduring Mistreatment of the Mentally Ill, Anatomy of an Epidemic, Magic Bullets, Psychiatric Drugs, and the Astonishing Rise of Mental Illness, and Psychiatry Under the Influence, Institutional Corruption, Social Injury, and Prescriptions for Reform. Robert Whittaker, welcome.
It's very nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Robert, you've written three books that outline the history of psychiatry and numerous award-winning newspaper and magazine articles on the mentally ill and the pharmaceutical industry. Before we dive into your books, take us back a little bit and tell us, how and why did you first get into this area of research?
You know, I actually had no particular interest in psychiatry. I was a medical reporter for a newspaper for a number of years. And then I actually then co-founded a publishing company that looked at the development of new drugs from a business angle. And what happened was, this was back in the 1990s, I started uncovering instances of abuse of psychiatric patients in research settings. So I said to the Boston Globe, I'd like to do a series on this. Now, at this time, I had a completely conventional understanding of psychiatry. My understanding was that we were uncovering the biological causes of schizophrenia and other disorders, and we have drugs that fix those chemical imbalances, like insulin for diabetes, which is a story of great progress. And that's what I had written about in, say, medical reporting, et cetera. But then while I was doing this series for the Boston Globe that really just focused on sort of abuses of patients in research settings, and particularly abuses of patients diagnosed with schizophrenia, I came upon two studies that challenged what I knew to be true, or even belied what I knew to be true. The first was two studies done by the World Health Organization, in which they compared outcomes in the United States and five other developed countries with outcomes in, quote, three developing countries, India, Colombia, and Nigeria. And they twice found that outcomes were much better in India and Nigeria than in the US and these rich countries. Now, one of the great things about, if we look at accomplishments in sort of developed world in the past century, a lot of it has to do with medicine. We've made great medical advances. But why would living in a developing country make you likely to have a better outcome? And then what really, I investigated that a bit more. I looked into these studies. And after the first such study, the World Health Organization investigator said, maybe the reason for the better outcomes in the poor or developing countries is that they're more medication compliant. These were studies of schizophrenia patients. Maybe they take their medications more regularly. So in the second study, they looked at that and they found, in fact, that in the developing countries, they used antipsychotics differently. They used them acutely, but not chronically. In other words, they kept people on the drugs initially, but only 16% of patients were maintained on the drugs long term, whereas in the United States and other developed countries, that's the standard of care. So my understanding at this time was that antipsychotics were an absolutely essential treatment for the long-term, you know, care of people diagnosed with schizophrenia, but that belied that. And by the way, there was one line in the World Health Organization studies that made me want to write about this at greater length. They said this: living in a developed country is, quote, a strong predictor that if you're diagnosed with schizophrenia, that you won't have a good outcome. And you can just see with that phrase, the sort of tragedy that is happening in developed countries. And I wanted to know why. And then I came upon a second study. This was done by Harvard researchers, and they just looked at long-term outcomes for schizophrenia patients over the past century. And here's what they reported. One, the recovery rate actually was now no better than it had been in the first third of the 20th century. In other words, from 1900 to 1933, you saw a certain recovery rate, and we were no better today. That belied the story of progress. And then the other thing they reported was outcomes were declining in the modern time. They had declined since the 1970s. So that's the juxtaposition. It was what made me curious about this was that we have a story of progress. I believed in that story of progress. It fits into a larger narrative about medical progress. And yet here were studies done that belied that narrative, and there was something that needed to be investigated. So it was that curiosity, and also because if indeed living in a developed country is a strong predictor that you won't have a good outcome, we need to know that, and we need to know why, and we need to make changes, because you're talking about lives that are being diminished, you know, and the lives of families suffering because of this. And it really felt to me, this is a failure that needs to be investigated. And that's really what drew me to this whole subject.
Wow.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
You would think, wouldn't you? I mean, in the West, we tend to feel so superior.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is exactly. We're always exporting our mode of care to less developed countries or developing countries or poorer countries. What really you saw here in these World Health Organization studies is what can we learn by what they're doing right in India and Nigeria. And by the way, the diagnosis was being done by Western doctors, so it wasn't a matter of diagnosing schizophrenia differently. So that they had standardized the diagnosis of who we're looking at. But they found that the course just ran very differently in developing countries where people were treated in a different way.
How were they treated in your research? Did you find that out?
Well, so in these particular World Health Organization studies, they were people initially being treated in hospitals, okay? Whether it be in rural India or sort of, a bigger city in India. But what they were finding was people were being released back to their communities. They weren't being kept on antipsychotic medication. And what they were, what they found really is that led to them being able to find a place back in society, working in the fields or having some place in society. They didn't become isolated, mm-hmm. Apart from the rest of their society. So that was a big part of it. In fact, one of the really interesting things is those two studies, one was 2 years in length, another one was 5 years in length. And then they went back 15 years later and looked at how people were doing. Now, in the developed countries, a lot of people were heavily medicated and sort of in group homes, not really engaged in meaningful work, that sort of thing. In India and Nigeria, they found people were working. Maybe it was out in the fields and all, but one of the sort of funny stories they told the investigators is when they went, for example, to the people in rural India that they had, studied years before, those people said, okay, I can give you a little bit of time for your follow-up, but listen, I have to work. Yeah. So what really is clear is in those developing countries, people by and large were able to get reintegrated into the society. They weren't shunned, they weren't isolated. And they were able to have some sort of meaningful participation in that society. And frankly, with the fact that they weren't being maintained on the antipsychotics made it seem that they had greater cognitive function and they were able to bring emotional engagement to their society. So at the very least, for me, that difference in outcomes, and again, I want to say where I started here. My understanding was that antipsychotics were absolutely essential. You needed to be on these medications. It just made me begin to say how did that narrative get created and how scientific was it?
And also too, did you find that their families gave them a lot of support. They were surrounded by their families or their friends. Yeah. Did they have a lot beside the work that they were doing? Were they getting a lot of support in that area, in those areas?
Yeah, by and large, if they weren't being drawn into some sort of Western model of care, they remained with their families. That's the point. They weren't separated from their families.
Yeah.
And often, the best outcomes were, in fact, in rural India, in rural Nigeria, where it's not like they had a group home to stash people off in. It was they were still with their families. Mm-hmm. And I've talked to some of the people that were involved in that and said, there's within those cultures, there was also a greater tolerance for eccentricity, so to speak.
Yeah.
Different, so there was less stigma.
Yes. Yeah.
Good. Less stigma.
Less stigma. And I actually, this is a related. I was good friends with someone from Cameroon who worked, and he came from a tribal area, and he worked with, quote, the cure of the sick heads. Okay. Is what the shaman was. But every year they had a parade in their particular village. And you know who led the parade? Those who were the eccentric, et cetera. They were given an exalted place. And there was one woman he talked about. For example, she sold soup all the time. She made soup. She had a place. And if she did something, he was just talking about this one person he knew. And let's say she did something weird, like strip her clothes off and run around. It's okay.
Yeah.
It was just so that there was a culture that didn't reject them,
right?
Is what you saw here, and that's clearly an element of that.
Yeah, so we didn't feel. I'm sorry, Sandy.
No, carry on.
This is such a hot topic with me. They didn't feel judged, and they felt comfortable in their surroundings. So they had that freedom. They had that trust. And because with my brother, he was diagnosed, quote, with schizophrenia, he was on all kinds of medication. And I fought for a long time not to have him on the medication. And he was in the group home. So I just applaud everything that you are doing so far in speaking about this, because I am such an advocate about what you're saying.
What you're saying is showing us that, there's a lot of talk about artificial intelligence, and we are being made to think of ourselves as operating in one way only, like little robots. The eccentricity, the quirky parts of our human nature are no longer acceptable. And we're stigmatizing people for that.
Yeah, at our Mad in America, I run this website, and we just did an interview with a man named Peter Sterling, who's a neuroscientist, and he spoke exactly about this. If you look at the evolution of the human brain, there's like 200 brain circuits. But we grew up, we succeeded, Homo sapiens, as a group. And what he says is you'll see in those, there's people who have different talents, and their brain circuits are organized differently. And so someone's a musician, someone's a social person, et cetera. And what we've done is, Sandy, it's just what you said, is you have to be through this narrow box to be considered normal now. And like, well, if you're a kid who doesn't like school much, then you're abnormal. Mm-hmm. And what he was saying, if you really look at our neuroscience, our sort of the way our brains are made up, we're made to have a lot of variation within the species, because it actually makes the species stronger. But with this AI and all, we're saying, basically you have to fit within this narrow way of being. And it's also, we've forgotten, like, it's almost like we've forgotten the history of like our literature, religious tracts, because people struggle with their minds, right?
Yeah.
Kids struggle growing up. We suffer. We're emotional. And now all of a sudden we've got this new DSM or this new categorization of people that, don't get too happy, or, you got to be able to be in this environment. And this is a big problem. I think we've lost a philosophy of being as we even try to talk about this. And part of the loss is an understanding that people, they can be eccentric with their many different sort of behaviors. And the other thing is we struggle. Yes. Human beings struggle. We're emotional creatures. Okay. And somehow our new diagnostic manual doesn't have that philosophical sense.
No. Yeah.
And they're doing this to the kids. I mean, I was talking to Rebecca earlier about Tom Hartman's book, The Edison Gene, and how, you know, this is the creative gene. This is what enabled us to evolve. And if we keep giving our kids Ritalin, you know, we are really trying to get rid of that particular creativity gene.
You know, it's just what's being done to the kids just breaks my heart. Because, you know, kids, as you know, they come, anybody who's been a parent and even had three kids, they're not all alike.
Right.
They arrive differently. And the point is, in any sort of class, there's all sorts of types of kids. And honestly, you're right. The very kid that may not be so good at sort of staying, you know, focused in class, that may be the person who's so inventive later on.
Or yes.
So entrepreneurial later on.
Yes.
I'm watching a story about a documentary about Albert Einstein right now, and he didn't fit so well within classroom settings.
Yeah.
So, and this thing where we diagnose them and medicate them, it's a tragedy.
Yeah.
It is.
And Van Gogh, look at him. I mean, they thought he was, quote, crazy, but look what he created. I feel they're extremely creative people, and it helps them when they tap into that creativity. It's an expression for them.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, there's also a beautiful line by, I think it was Harry Stack Sullivan, about people diagnosed with schizophrenia. And he worked with people so diagnosed. He says, I've actually never met people so sensitive to the slings and arrows that come our way. And it's almost like they're extra sensitive souls so often.
Yes,
they are.
And you know what? Society doesn't want extra sensitive souls. Mm-hmm. Society doesn't want too many creative people, just enough, you know, but not too many. It's, you know, dangerous. I mean, talk a bit about how this narrative started then, because you wrote in one of your books about the landmark studies in the 70s that said prolonged treatment courses could be harmful. And then the pharmaceutical companies and the psychiatry got together, and suddenly we're seeing a whole aggressive campaign to drug people.
Yeah, I think this is really important as to how to understand how we got the belief system we do have now.
Yeah.
And basically what happened was this, and I'll go back to what you're talking about, because it was known in the 1970s that over the long term, say even antipsychotics might make people more psychotic. We never hear about that, but it's in the scientific literature. What really happened was this. American psychiatry in the 1970s was feeling threatened. There was a lot of competition with counselors and psychologists for patients and their talk therapies. Well, how effective were they? That sort of thing. And there was sort of an anti-psychiatry movement that psychiatry really wasn't a medical branch. It focused more as a social control branch. So psychiatry, American psychiatry felt a need to reinvent themselves, you know, sort of improve their reputation in society. Mm-hmm. And they said, how can we do that? We need to put on the white coat. Because doctors have such prestige in our society. So what they did is when they rewrote, they published the third edition of their Diagnostic and Statistical Manual in 1980, and they said, we're going to conceptualize mental problems as diseases of the brain. Okay? Now, as they presented that model to society, they didn't say it was a hypothesis. They said, oh, we're finding out that these are diseases of the brain. And pretty soon we then also heard that these problems, depression, schizophrenia, were due to chemical imbalances, and that we had drugs that fixed those chemical imbalances like insulin for diabetes. And in terms of the commercialization of this idea, it really happened when Prozac was brought to market in 1988. It's a new wonder drug. It makes you feel better than well, et cetera. So that's a story of great medical progress. And if it were true, and by the way, I thought it was true, because when I was covering medicine, that's what I was told. But if it's true, that would be the greatest medical discovery in some ways, I would think, of all time. And here's what I mean by this. The human brain is so extraordinarily complex, right? It's the most complex thing in the universe. And we were being told they had identified the molecule that caused madness, the molecule that caused depression, and they could set it right. Think about that. If that were so, That would be an amazing discovery. Mm-hmm. And then we organize ourselves as a society around this story. And that with the idea, there's a line over here, are the abnormal people, and over here are the normal people. Okay. Here's, you either have the illness or you don't. And this led, and the pharmaceutical companies love this new conception of psychiatric disorders. And the reason they did is this: to get a drug approved for market, it has to be for an illness. Like, you can't get a pill approved for unhappiness or you know, the struggles of with divorce, but you can get it for depression. You can get it for the illness of anxiety. And this new conception in DSM all of a sudden made all of these sort of more ordinary problems that people suffered from into diseases, and pharmaceutical industry understood, wow, we can expand the market. And we can expand it into kids now too. And that's what they did. So for example, in 1987, the United States spent about $800 million on psychiatric drugs. By 2010, we were spending $40 billion. Wow. That's a 50-fold increase. Now, and the number of people being treated soared during this time, right? Because you'd go in, you'd say, I just got divorced. Or they say, we have a chemical imbalance, and I'll take this drug. Or if your kid wasn't doing well in, you know, school, ADHD, take Ritalin and all. But going back to your first point, what I looked at is, if this story is true, that we have this great medical advance, you should accept the burden of that disease to go down, right? That's what happens when you make great medical advances. But what we saw instead was this extraordinary rise in people disabled by mental illness. So, for example, in the United States, in 1987, when Prozac comes in, we had 1.25 million adults receiving a disability payment because of mental illness. By 2010, it was closing in on 4.5 million. And then I started looking at other societies, other developed societies, and you saw it over and over again as they adopted this story, this narrative of progress. Disability rates went up. So what you see, that's the first step. We organized ourselves around a false narrative of progress because, in fact, if you go into the chemical imbalance story, you find that it was always a hypothesis. It was a hypothesis that arose not by studies of people with a diagnosis, but instead by an understanding of how the drug acted on the brain. So, for example, the low serotonin theory of depression. They came to understand that antidepressants worked by upping serotonergic activity in the brain. Therefore, they hypothesized maybe depression is due to too little serotonin. Mm-hmm. Or say with schizophrenia, they know that antipsychotics block dopamine, they lower dopamine activity. So they said, maybe schizophrenia is due to too much dopamine activity in the brain. That's the hypothesis. But now they have to investigate, do people with depression have an abnormal serotonergic system before they go on the drugs? And as early as 1984, the National Institute of Mental Health, studying that question, said, we're not finding anything wrong with the serotonergic system in people diagnosed with depression. Now, the story with schizophrenia, people diagnosed with schizophrenia, is a bit more complex. But as early as 1990s, leading schizophrenia researchers were saying, the simple dopamine excess hypothesis of schizophrenia is no longer credible. And in 2005, Kenneth Kendler, who was one of the world's leading experts into this investigation of the chemical imbalance theory of mental disorders, said, we have hunted for big, simple chemical explanations for mental disorders, and we have not found them. So here's the difference. We have a population being told, we've seen that these chemical imbalances are the cause of mental disorders, but the science was saying we're not finding them. And then there's one other element to this that is particularly tragic. And this goes back to, Sandy, to what you were saying. What they found was that, in fact, the drugs induce the very imbalance hypothesized to cause the problem in the first place. So, for example, antipsychotics, what do? They block dopamine receptors, they thwart it, they slow it down. But your brain, being this extraordinarily neuroplastic organ, says, uh-oh, I've got to up my dopamine receptors in order to compensate, in order to try to maintain a normal functioning of this dopamine system. And so what researchers said, these drugs are inducing a dopamine supersensitivity. This goes back to the late 70s, and this biological change may make these patients more vulnerable to psychosis than they would be in the normal course of their illness. And so this horrible thing starts up in the late 1970s. There was further investigations in the early 1980s about how the drugs could sort of induce a chronic psychosis, more severe psychosis over time, but the public never heard about this.
There's another alarming piece to this story as well, and that is the racial bias in psychiatry. Oh. And the statistics that African-Americans, are often misdiagnosed as schizophrenic, and they receive excessive doses of medication.
This is really well established. I mean, there was even a study once where they just had a group of symptoms that they sent out to psychiatrists. This description was the same for everybody, except one thing was changed. Was it a white male, white female, black male, black female? Now, which group was most likely to be diagnosed with schizophrenia? Now, the symptoms are the same.
Yeah.
It was the black male. Then it was actually the black female was next, and then white female, and then white male at that point was the last. And the point is, not only this, as you can see, dosages are higher depending on race.
Yep.
And this is still with us today. And if you look at, for example, foster care in the United States, you see children of color just being hammered with these drugs.
We're going to go to break now. You're listening to Crack the Podcast with me, Sandy Sedgbeer, and my co-host, Rebecca Shaper. And we're speaking with former award-winning author and science journalist, Robert Whittaker, about his books, Mad in America, Anatomy of an Epidemic, and Psychiatry Under the Influence, which document the enduring mistreatment of the mentally disabled. We'll be back with more from Robert Whittaker after the break.
The Real Conscious Connection, Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times. Co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Hello, I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, host of Om Times Magazine's flagship radio show, What is Going On? My passion is sifting through information, research, and innovations from New Thought teachers, speakers, and researchers pushing back the boundaries of what we know about life, energy, metaphysics, and the universe. I love shifting perceptions about who we are, why we're here, and how quickly impossible becomes normal when we open our minds, expand our awareness, and accept that the only limits that exist are those we place upon ourselves. So if you're the kind of forward-thinking, eager investigator of what lies beyond the current reality that most perceive, why not make a date to come play with me in the field of possibilities at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time every Thursday, and together we can discover what's really going on.
Worried about your friend but don't know how to reach out?
You can say how are you or get a fake tattoo. You can ask with an app if it works for you. You can chat with them in VR. It's all good if you think you should check in. Yeah, you should.
Whatever gets you talking.
Reach out to a friend about their mental health.
Whatever gets you talking.
Learn how you can help at seizetheawkward.org.
Welcome back, Robert Whittaker. We've covered a number of successful alternative approaches to mental issues. Things that are treating anxiety, depression, PTS, and other mental health behaviours, etc., very successfully. What chance do you think that any of these have? I mean, are the drugs companies so embedded into the system, so powerful, that they will lobby and fight against anything that threatens their profits?
Yeah, that's a great question. Can I just say one thing we were talking about just before? I think it's important to say, it doesn't mean that drugs may not have a place.
Right.
The question is, you have to be honest about what they do, and then you can start figuring out for whom and for how long, which is really how medications need to be used in every instance, this question. But the problem is we were given a false narrative that prevents that sort of thoughtful, selective use of the medication. So I just wanted that to be clear.
It's probably the only industry where they keep giving you the same drug again and again and again.
Yeah, and, exactly. Yeah.
Yes, and that's where they keep trying to do the cocktail, which one is best for the individual, and it keeps, and that could go up to like 6 months until, and then what about the patient that is trying to wean off? Isn't that really difficult, getting off of some of these psychotic drugs? You want to speak about that, or do you want to go to the next question?
They're even like related a bit. That's the problem. I mean, by the way, these whole cocktails are an example of a failed paradigm of care. If you're on 5-6 drugs, that's not working for you.
Some people who've been, yes.
Yeah. And then, you know, we have all, you get on these drugs, they have side effects, and your drugs for the side effects. And next, you know, you have a pill box. It's crazy. Mm-hmm. And, but now to your point is even tapering off. Once you're on, your brain does adapt to that drug. We know this happens, and that's why coming off can be so difficult, especially after longer periods of time. And just now, finally, they're spinning some attention to, well, how can we do this safely? And, you know, what are some protocols for doing it? I actually helped found an organization called the International Institute for Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, which brought together researchers and doctors to really study this very question, because we've been using these drugs for 60 years. And there was no attention to how do you get people off successfully and what is happening. So that's, I think that's part of the alternatives you're actually talking about, by developing a different paradigm.
Yes, absolutely.
The reason, and listen, there's all sorts of evidence that you can find sort of environmental ways of helping people, because we human beings respond to our environment. That's what we're meant to do. And everything from, you know, physical things, social situations, having meaning in life, good diets, all those sort of things we know can be nurturing health. So really, I think so often what you're talking about in some of these alternatives is you're no longer trying to fix it and disease. What you're trying to do is build an environment that's supportive. And then you can start asking, what do we all need? Well, we do need, it's good to have someone to love and someone to love you. It's good to have shelter, good to have food, exercise. We recently did a story about people coming out of mental hospitals being introduced to communal music singing. So they would, so not just that, it was with a big community singing. Now, once they sing in the community, they're no longer, quote, the mental patient. They're just part of a group singing. And it turns out that's a great thing. And what you see over and over again is people, is attempts to change the environment in ways that are more nurturing generally have a very positive effect. Even with psychosis, there's a program that was developed somewhat along these lines in northern Finland in the late 1980s, early 1990s. They completely changed their outcomes for their first episode psychotic patients, and we can talk about that. But why don't we have more about this? It's because generally we live in a capitalistic society. You don't make real profits from, you know, improving environments, right? There's no product that, like a drug that all of a sudden sends profits to shareholders. The other problem is, frankly, psychiatry boxed itself in. They became prescribers of drugs, and they left the counseling up to other groups. So as a guild now, they're really devoted to one product, and that's psychiatric drugs or other somatic treatments like ECT and stuff. So in terms of change, the problem we have is this model of care, this disease model of care, produces great profits for drug companies. It also does help make psychiatry as a guild the most powerful guild, the authority over this domain of our lives. And they've boxed themselves in because they've given up really on that they're the ones that manage environmental programs. But this disease model is turning into such a failure for society, such a failure for our kids. You know, like 25-30% of our kids by the time they're 21 have a diagnosis and a prescription. There is this sense of things have failed. We need to rethink this. And there's all these grassroots movements where people are saying, like the Hearing Voices movement.
Yeah.
People hear voices.
Yes.
And they turn to each other for support. Well, that's really taken off.
Yeah. And peer-to-peer.
Peer-to-peer and, you know, mm-hmm. looking at, and what is peer-to-peer? That's like finding a place where you have meaning among others.
Yes. Yeah.
Right? And you can share experiences. Yeah. So, and, you know, you see changing schools. I mean, there was one experiment a while back. You know what they did in the school? It was a school with a lot of ADHD. It was a sort of troubled school. What they did is they threw out all the Coke machines. They threw out all the processed foods. And they began cooking real food for breakfast, cooking real food for lunch. And they also taught the kids to cook.
Mm.
And so nutrition and thinking about nutrition became, and guess what happened to their ADHD? It went down like this.
Yes.
The problem was, it was more expensive. You were actually giving the kids real food.
Yeah.
So I think this is one of the frustrating things. We all do have a sense of, you know, what you need to keep well, right? Mm-hmm. Rebecca, you know what you need. You need to be in a world where you have a place.
Yes.
Where you have some meaning, where you have social connections.
Yep.
And, you know, anybody, if they lose that, stop sleeping, eat a terrible diet, get divorced, lose your job, how many people do well after that?
Yeah. And I think that nature is a huge component to
this. Oh, I agree.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's my archetype as a nature girl. But that leads me to a question to ask you. Are you familiar with open dialogue? Because I know you mentioned Finland. And do you feel this type of therapy is successful? Is this what you were alluding to earlier?
Yeah, I was. And in Anatomy of an Epidemic, I went to Northern Finland to report on open dialogue. Mm-hmm. And the reason I went there was twofold. One, they were reporting the best 5-year outcomes for psychotic patients anywhere in the world. And here's what it was. That was number one why I was interested. Number two is they used antipsychotics differently. They used them selectively. Mm-hmm. And what was done in Northern Finland was this way. People would come in first episode and they would throw a lot of sort of environmental resources around them. They'd work with the whole family, not just the individual, because they had the sense that the problem was there was a break in the in-between spaces between people. In other words, the problem didn't just reside in the head of the individual. It resided in these in-between spaces. And the idea was you repaired those in-between spaces, which was meant to sort of repair the relationship to the family, to the environment, to schools, etc. Now, initially, when people came in, they didn't put them on antipsychotics. You know why? They felt that in the absence of medications, many people could start getting better naturally, but also they could bring more emotional, a sort of energy capacity to these dialogical meetings. Now, if someone wasn't getting better after 3-4 weeks, they'd say, hey, maybe you would benefit from an antipsychotic, and they would put people on a low dose. And then after about 6 months, they'd see of those who'd been exposed, who could come off and who needed to be on the drug long term. So it's a selective use model. And here's their outcomes. If you look at the first episode patients, 5 years later, first episode psychotic patients,
mm-hmm.
5 years later, 80% are working or back in school and asymptomatic.
Yeah.
Only 20% have gone on to, sort of chronic disability. Well, we don't see anything like that with our paradigm of care. We shunt the majority of people go down that chronic disability pathway. So that's an example of a program that's been done. We've been done for decades. It's not an anti-drug program. It's a best use of program. And it's proven to be successful. They studied every patient that came through them. And they also did a 20-year study, by the way, too. And you see better outcomes over 20 years. So in a way, it's being adopted in other countries. There's a whole movement now to introduce people to dialogical trainings. But they're missing one component as it imported. They don't use the selective use of antipsychotics.
Yeah.
So they marry this sort of conception with regular use of the drugs. And I hate to say it, but Sweden did something like that many years ago, and they weren't getting the same good outcomes that the Finns were.
I do know there are places like in Emory that is using the open dialogue. And I believe there is a place called the Cottages, Grady Hospital in Atlanta, Georgia. That yep. I know you're going to be, I have to pause right here. My landscape people are here, and I'm sorry if you hear the noise.
That's okay.
I can't move. This, so I apologize. But anyway, yeah, there is hope here in the U.S. for open dialogue.
Yeah, that I think that program in Atlanta you're talking about in some ways was funded through something called the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care.
Yeah.
And I actually helped start that organization after Anatomy of an Epidemic for that exact purpose, to provide, funding and resources for these sort of pilot projects we needed to see happen. And you're right. I guess Emory is really taking it to heart.
Yes. And at Grady, they have a place called the Cottages where they do offer the open dialogue. And I live in Atlanta. So, yeah.
That's a sign of hope, you're right. You have to rethink possibilities before you do that.
There you go.
And it's interesting that Finland is regarded as one of the happiest, quality of life. Finland tops the chart. Look at the way they education in schools. The things that they're doing are quite different and they're very successful.
Yeah. Can I say one thing about Finland? You're absolutely right about the schools and all. This was just done in one very small part of Finland, just the north. It never took over. I mean, it arose out of a national Finnish study, but for whatever reason, in the 1980s, it only really took hold in the north, around in Western Lapland.
Well, that leads me to the next question, which is, you, the founder and publisher of Mad in America, and your website features research news and blogs by international writers who are all dedicated to rethinking psychiatry. In an ideal world, what would you do if you were in charge of this?
Okay. Well, first of all, I think the reason about Mad in America, why we formed it, is because we think it's a societal responsibility to rethink how we care for those who are struggling and ourselves. So that's the thing. It's sort of a collective group thing, like how will we respond to each other and those who are really struggling, et cetera, et cetera. And I think it's a societal thing. What I would do is I'd start honestly, I think we need to remember who we are as a species, so to speak. I really think we have to revisit our Shakespeare and we have to revisit our religious tracts, our literature, our philosophy, and we have to understand human beings struggle. Kids struggle with their minds too.
Yeah.
And you grow up, it's not this generally like nice thing growing up, a straight line. I mean, we all struggle with our minds, our behavior and all. So I would say, we have to get rid of the diagnosis, that whole conception we have right now that either you're mentally ill or you're not mentally ill. We just have to say there's all sorts of manifestations of behavior, thinking, and feelings. And they really come on the human spectrum. That's number one. I think then the second is, a different philosophy, one that's really consistent with what we see in the past, in our literature, et cetera. The second thing I think we have to be is humble. Is we don't really know what's causing these things so often. I mean, we can often see that trauma's at play or some setback in life, but there's many pathways, say, to psychosis. I mean, it's clear that lead and gasoline actually help. When we were having leaded gasoline, it actually was fueling, some bouts of schizophrenia, et cetera. There are viruses that can cause this. Anyway, we need to be humble about the mysteries of the mind and recognize that there can be many pathways to difficulty, to madness, whatever we want to call it. And once you understand that, there can be many solutions in a sense.
Yes.
Rather than one size fits all. And then finally, I'd say, we need to ask ourselves, what do we all need? What do you need? What do I need? And what we all need, really, well, we'll start with kids. Kids need to feel safe.
Yeah.
Kids need to have a secure place. They don't need to be worried about where food's coming or whether there's going to be abuse in the house or someone shot outside their front window. So we need to focus on, what do we all need to stay well? How do you nurture a healthy society? How do you do that with your kids? How do you do those for adults that struggle in some ways? And it's not a mystery. You really, what do you, if I ask you, if I go on the street, what do you need? I need to have meaning in my life. I need to have someone to love or someone to love me. Shelter helps. Good food. You said nature. The programs that give people to just go out and walk in nature, they're quite effective, actually.
Yeah.
That sort of meditative thing.
Yeah.
So you asked me what I would do. I would say we need to reconceptualize the whole thing. And it really is around a philosophy of being. What is it like to be a human being? And how can societies best nurture, you know, mental wellness in their members? And how can they best tend to each other when something goes awry? And there is a beautiful moment in the past from the Quakers in the late 1700s and early 1800s where they basically did that. They said, and Quakers, of course, have the sense of brethren. You know what I mean? We're all equal before God.
Yeah.
And they said, we don't know why madness happens, but we said, we do know they may have, the person who's gone mad has a God-given capacity to regain their sanity. And if they don't, we still have an obligation to treat them as brethren, which means good food, shelter. And they built these asylums out in nature because they thought nature could be healing. And so there is this humble, beautiful model in the past that talks about, because this program is about stigma. Well, instead of calling them the other, the mentally ill, how about if we call them brethren and think of them as brethren, which of course they are. And then if you conceive of them as each other as brethren, what follows from that is, well, what do I need to do to help this brethren do well?
Yes.
And even if they don't do well, what sort of world do I need to try to provide them comfort?
Exactly. And it's like going up to the individual and say, I see you, I hear you. And also, too, I think there's a shame-based society out there as well.
Yeah, and we have, you say, you know, Rebecca, you just named two things that I think are so important. I see you, I hear you, first of all, right? Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things we were told around people with schizophrenia is they lacked insight to their own illness. That right. shut, that we closed their ears to us. We mm-hmm. didn't see them, we didn't hear them. And then the second thing is we have this narrative about how violent they are, right? Yeah. First of all, that's like taking like one little, you know, you have so many people and you have one episode and then you stigmatize everybody with that.
Yes, yes.
And it's just part of like what when you define somebody as the other, as different from you, you tell all sorts of stories about those people that aren't rooted in fact, but just appeal to sort of, you know, our fears, you know.
Yeah, I was going to say
that. That sort of thing.
Yep.
But that's endemic in society today, isn't it? I mean, we see this expressed in so many ways, the Me Too movement, you know, the wars between the sexes, so-called, the Black Lives Matter, you know, the way we treat other people. Everybody is an other.
Yeah, no, this is a real problem, I think, for democracies right now is too much a sense of tribalism.
Yes.
This person's different from me.
Yes.
Et cetera, et cetera.
We're all one.
Democracies are based on that.
What you're saying makes so much sense. We all know that. Is anybody listening who has the power to do something?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, the people who are listening, it's really coming from the grassroots up. People who say something's wrong with what's been going on. And, you know, you do see some pilot projects in smaller countries that are more responsive to their population. So, for example, in Norway, user groups, you know, people have been in mental hospitals, et cetera, they got together and they began petitioning the health ministry for medication-free treatment. In other words, they could still go in a hospital. They could still get some security or whatever they needed there, but they didn't want to, if they didn't want to, they wanted to be able to be there without being put on antipsychotics, okay? Now, the psychiatric profession resisted that, but the people continued to work with the health ministry. continue to make actually an evidence-based case for it. And then the health minister a few years ago said, every one of our health districts has to begin offering this care. And there is now actually a hospital, a private hospital in Norway, that is just helping chronic patients get off their medications. And what they're finding is they're talking, their first patient was a woman who had been hospitalized 221 times. Wow. She came to them with on 31 medications. She weighed, I don't know, 400 pounds, something like this. She'd been on so many medications and all. And she had been in solitary confinement under watch for the last 3 years, not allowed to go out, et cetera. Right. They went to, she got an ability to be transferred to this private hospital. It's a great story. You know what this, the administrators did? They're actually two psychiatric nurses. The very first thing they did for her, they sent her with a nurse to Mallorca to build trust, to show that she could be out of the hospital and that she could be trusted. Anyway, 3 years later, she's down to, I think, one drug. She's lost a lot of weight. She's working, living on her own. And you actually are seeing that progression with a lot of these people who were seen as chronically ill, but are now giving a different path forward. And so you asked, do I see any hope and where does it come from? That came from patient groups, really. That's where that came from. Yeah. There's a group in Israel that's really changing things, and that came from, there was really two sources. They're called Soteria houses in Israel. Mm. It comes from family members who saw their kid do very poorly on antipsychotics. And the family happened to be the one that saw this, an entrepreneurial family. So they had some resources. And Israel also is a smaller country. And then there was a psychiatrist who'd been working in hospitals and says, my patients aren't getting better. I got to do something differently. And so they built these homes that are meant to be really for psychotic patients, where it's an environment, some people are on meds, some people are not, but the idea is by being in a community over time, cooking with each other, going on hikes and that sort of thing, people get better and you're seeing it successful. Again, it didn't start from the top down. It was a movement really built by one psychiatrist and one family.
Yeah. Well, we're almost out of time. I know Rebecca's got one final really important question to ask you, which is, you know, go ahead, Rebecca.
Can I just wing it? And then
of course you can.
Okay, great. What made you decide to do this? Did you go through something in your life that compelled you to be an advocate on mental health?
There's sort of a two-part answer to that. Of course, anybody alive has known people who have struggled. Mm-hmm. In ways. Okay. So it's not like I wasn't aware of people close to me struggling. Okay. But that actually wasn't the initial motivation at all. What really was the motivation, what I spoke about in the beginning, was that we had a failure, a medical, you know, this failure in this thing. And then that there was a story we were organizing ourselves around that just didn't turn out to be true. And so really it was as from a journalist's point of view was what got me involved, because a journalist is supposed to be, there's an old thing, you're supposed to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. And this seemed like an ideal opportunity to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. And I just really felt like here was a tragedy unfolding in our society, affecting so many individuals. And by the way, I did know people who had been so diagnosed and not done well. And I also knew that there was this medicating of kids, but it really was a journalistic impulse to be, can I be a better communicator of the science? That's number one. Also, if there's alternatives. And also the other thing was, very early on, I was told, don't listen to people with schizophrenia. Okay, they don't know what they're talking about. They don't know they're ill. They don't know what's good for them. Well, any journalist knows when you're told that, you're hearing a group of people being silenced.
Yeah.
And your job is to listen.
Yeah.
And if there's a group being silenced, is to sort of honor what they say. And that's one of the things I did in this book, Mad in America, is to incorporate the testimony, the life experiences, the voices of those who've been treated, because their voice, their story is very different from the treaters.
Yes.
So really that was, so it's a great question. So many people do have a personal tragedy that makes them sort of advocates or sort of interested in this. Mm-hmm. I think I had the ordinary experiences of knowing, you know, people who got sucked into this and struggled and, you know, suicides, that sort of thing. But that wasn't the motivating factor.
Well, you're
we're going to have to leave it here because we're a few seconds away from. So, Robert, thank you for joining us. Mad in America is the name of one of your books. It's also the name of your website. And Anatomy of an Epidemic, Psychiatry Under the Influence. Fantastic books. Fantastic website, full of all kinds of information that people can take advantage of. And yeah, we're going to invite you back on later in the year because there's so much more to talk about here. Well, but we do have to leave it here.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. It was really a good discussion, enjoyable discussion.
It was, so thanks for being a voice for this.
Yes, absolutely.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Okay, that's it, everybody. Thank you for joining us today. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time with another episode of Crack the Podcast. Till then, it's goodbye from me.
And me, Rebecca Shaver.
And don't forget, there's a crack in everything. It's where the light gets in.
Thanks again, Robert.